Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program that addresses challenges faced regionally, the need for and consequences of change, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is provided in collaboration with the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation and KCBX. Chris Kington Barker is your host today, and she's joined by guests for part two of the Alzheimer's Show and a discussion about caregiver challenges, where resources can be found, and support that is and isn't offered through our healthcare system. Although we can't take your calls today because we are doing this remotely, you can be part of the discussion by emailing your questions to voices@kcbx.org, or you can call us right here at the station at 805-549-8855, and we'll be happy to forward those on to the panel. With that, let's join Chris Kington Barker and her guests. Over to you, Chris.
Thank you, Brad. 7 million people in the U.S. are living with Alzheimer's, and more than 11 million provide their unpaid care. In California, 12% of adults over the age of 65 are afflicted with Alzheimer's disease, resulting in a total unpaid hour of unpaid care in California is 1,884,000 hours. At a total value of unpaid care of 44,272,000 hours a year. Currently, 20% of hospice residents have a primary diagnosis of dementia, and the number is continuing to climb. My guests today are here to talk about this growing health and social issue from the perspective of caregivers and a care manager. Joining me are Kim Chartran, RN, Care Manager for Hospice of San Luis Obispo County, Sue Raycraft, and Linda Holloway, who both are caregivers of individuals that they've been caring for or have cared for. And welcome, all three of you today. Thank you for joining us at Central Coast Voices. And I'm going to start with you, Kim. Can you talk a little bit about, in your role as a caregiver, or excuse me, a care manager for Hospice of San Luis Obispo County, what is that and what do you do?
Oh, thanks, Chris. Well, you know, it's an interesting position of being able to help people plan for care, plan in advance for care, but sometimes planning on the spot for care that they need to provide for their loved ones. So often people are hospitalized unexpectedly, and then they are thrown into, the person is thrown into caregiving because this has been an unexpected need for caregiving. So they don't know what to do. A lot of times what I do is try to help people find resources, look for what is appropriate for what they need for their own circumstances, but then also try to get ahead of anything happening where we can plan down the line, like what is your immediate need, your midterm need, and maybe your long-term need, because you might have in mind what you think you need, or what you think like insurance is going to cover, or what, you know, resources you might have, but it, you know, it can be very different than what people expect. So my role is really to advise and to help navigate in the healthcare system, and then also just to normalize the feelings that go along with being an unpaid family caregiver.
And Hospice Slo County is a little bit different as a hospice. Can you speak about that?
Sure. Yeah. You know, it was in the early 80s when Medicare decided to pay for hospice care that involved nurses and doctors and whatnot. But prior to that, all hospices were like our model, which was non-medical and volunteer, community-based. So in 1982, Hospice Slo County opted to stay a non-medical and volunteer hospice. When I first started at hospice almost 6 years ago, there were probably almost 100 volunteer hospices in the United States, and now we're down to 17. So San Luis Obispo County is very lucky to have our model hospice to be able to help people who have life-limiting illnesses. So you don't necessarily have to be at end of life to access our services because they're volunteer-based. And we work with a lot of other home health agencies and hospices as well.
And you're also the facilitator for a caregiver support group. And that's something that Hospice Slo started a little while ago. And what have you seen as the need for that group? Why?
Well, the big need, I think, is number one, to have it be a remote group, interestingly. And that was one of the gifts of COVID. There weren't many gifts from COVID, but that was one. So that the caregivers who need to be with their loved one are able to take a break to have some support for themselves, but stay in the home and not have to travel distances to have a support group. So the caregiver support group actually was originally being held in person every other week, and then it migrated to weekly online. And I joined probably about a year and a half ago when the counselor who was leading it had to step away. And it's just been a lovely place to emphasize, you know, the commonality of what everybody is going through as a caregiver, despite diagnosis, share feelings, have ideas for self-care, have an opportunity to encourage one another.
Yeah. And when I did the intro and we talk about caregiving on the rise, I mean, there's an astounding number of unpaid caregivers in this country. Our system just doesn't afford caregiving. It doesn't support caregiving. What are some of the things that you think are the biggest challenges for folks that you see in the support group and folks that you help care manage through the system?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the biggest things would be, in general, something that we call like the donut hole. So there's a gap between people who could possibly be supported through social services and between those people and the people who can actually afford caregiving, because caregiving is very costly if you pay for it. It's right now, most agencies, the entry rate is $40 an hour. You can sometimes find private caregivers for less than that, which, you know, is great, but it's still, you know, it's still a cost, I think, that people don't expect to find. So there's a big donut hole of people who they make too much to get social services and they make too little to be able to pay for care. So that's the challenge. And then that family caregiver becomes the sole 24/7 person, you know, that is providing the care, managing the care, and then what gets forgotten is their own care. And their own needs and their own, you know, sometimes they don't go to doctor's appointments, you know, because they can't get away. So that is one of the biggest problems we see. And I think also the emotional ride, I mean, there's very much a sense of anticipatory grieving. You know, when you're caring for a person at home, there's a decline that happens in pieces. And so you're mourning the loss of all sorts of things, the loss of opportunity, the loss of a lifestyle you thought you would have, but don't have, the loss of your independence, and then the loss of a partner or loved one that you're caring for, their capacity and their abilities to live a life that you once enjoyed together.
Yeah. Yeah. And Linda, I'm going to go over to you. Are you currently caring for someone?
I am currently caring for my husband.
Okay.
Who is in his second round of cancer treatments, but he's also been diagnosed with dementia.
Okay. How long ago did that, are you okay? How long ago did that diagnosis occur? Can you talk a little bit about how that?
I do apologize. Sorry.
It's all right.
The cancer was diagnosed in 2016 and the dementia in 2017.
Okay.
So, since the knee operation 2015, it's pretty much been a 24/7.
So it started with a knee operation.
It did. So the lab work afterwards kept showing that the kidneys weren't working 100%. And by doing a further research on that, they found out that it was multiple myeloma that was causing the kidneys to not function 100%.
Okay.
So we went through a year of cancer treatments and stem cell transplant. And about 6 months later, there were noticeable changes. And that led to the diagnosis of dementia.
Wow. So, how old was your husband when he was diagnosed with dementia?
It would have been 70, 71.
Okay. And Can you talk a little bit about what was helpful in your journey with this diagnosis and what kinds of things have been difficult and unhelpful?
The helpful part was he had his final cancer treatments up at Stanford, the stem cell transplant, and going to, back for follow-up, the doctor up there, I had explained my concerns about the memory and the shuffling and all of that, and he sent us over to a psychologist and a bunch of other things that came out with the diagnosis of dementia. The frustration was the local neurologist kept saying it was mild cognitive impairment. And from the caregiver's point of view, that was more of a hindrance than a blessing. I understand his, Gary was pretty much still functional at that point. But it, by the dementia, it then helped with some of the problems I was having. It took away a driver's license. But at that point, with his shuffling, I didn't feel comfortable that he should be driving a car. More of a physical, could he move his feet fast enough versus the mental? So, more frustration with the medical right at the moment. I think the biggest part is not having everybody on the same page, urologist, oncologist, and the renal doctor, fighting problems there.
Yeah, so you got validation and support from the physicians who finally said, no, this is a diagnosis of dementia.
Well, and they put them through 5 or 6 hours of training, of testing. Yeah. They really took it seriously to say, is there a problem or is there not? And a 15-minute appointment every 3 months or every 2 months was not getting to the root cause.
Did you know that the shuffling and some of the things that you were seeing were symptoms of dementia?
No.
You didn't?
No.
And Kim, I'm going to go back to you when we talk about the kind of warning signs of symptoms or signs of dementia. Can you speak to that?
Well, in this, yes. And it's interesting that Linda mentioned that shuffling was one of Gary's, you know, earliest signs. And I have talked to quite a number of people, surprising number of people, that mentioned that they went to the doctor for mobility issues and it turned out to be a neurocognitive issue. Sometimes it was Parkinson's, but a lot of times it was Alzheimer's. And people don't tend to think about Alzheimer's as being associated with mobility, but that can be one of the first things. There's also one of the biggest changes, and I'm sure as Laura mentioned last time you talked with her, it's more of the short-term memory loss, the inability to do and remember things in the recent past. So not remembering that you had breakfast, not remembering that you had lunch. Now, everyone forgets where they put their keys from time to time, or they can't find this paper or that. But it's a sort of more of a chronic issue with that short-term memory loss, but a great recollection of long-term memory. So some people will say, well, his memory's fine because he remembered, you know, that we got married 40 years ago or whatever. But he can't remember that, you know, he had his pills, or, you know, that he made breakfast, or that he had just gone to the doctor an hour before, you know, that kind of thing. So that's where you tend to see those things.
Are there any other signs that people should be aware of that might not occur to them?
Well, that's a really good question. I have to think about that, because it's like, you know, it's sort of like if you've seen one person with dementia, you've seen one person with dementia.
Yeah.
Very unique. There can be a defensiveness and thinking that if their mind's not working right, that people are thinking that they're mentally ill somehow. So there can be behavior changes, there can be mood changes, and increasing agitation. You know, things that used to be easier for people to do more calmly, that they get really impatient about, or they start having like anger outbursts. That can be another, you know, again, that mood and behavior changes that you can start to see that seem out of character for that person. and out of character for the situation too.
Yeah. I had my father, when he was starting to have memory issues, also would have shorter conversations.
Uh-huh.
It was easier for him to cover when he wasn't speaking for as long a period of time. And he would be unable to continue to have a phone conversation. So it would be kind of, you know, hi, babe. Oh, love you. Here's your mom. Mm. And would be off the phone quickly.
And that's a really good point, because that's a lot of times people will take their loved one to the doctor, you know, for something. I know this happened with my mother-in-law, actually, because we were concerned about her memory. So we went to go in to have a memory test. And of course, she was like, why are you doing this? And we said, oh, we just want to get a baseline. And then, you know, she just was on her best, and she was the good patient, and she was she could cover very easily.
Exactly.
When it counted. And that was, of course, kind of hallmark of the earlier to early mid stages of dementia. But exactly. The shortened conversations and the ability to have people outside of the family, for instance, saying, oh, your dad seems fine, or, you know, whoever, and the family going, but that's not our experience.
Exactly. Wait a few minutes. Yeah. Wait a half hour. Yeah. Sue, can you tell me a little bit about who you've been caring for?
Well, my experience is not with dementia at all. I'm very fortunate in that my husband has full mental capacity. His is advanced prostate cancer in his bones. But what I would like to share is the value of this group that hospice provides. I live in a rural area, far from any services, like halfway between King City and Paso Robles, out in, you know, rolling hills and dirt. Oh. So for me to get to services is the biggest challenge. And to find a program that reaches out to me where I am, and it's actually available as far south as King City and Monterey County.
Yeah.
Which is quite remarkable, and to meet me where I am and provide the kind of information, advice, and support. Oh my God, the support is amazing. And I just really want to encourage people to think about that availability. And Kim mentioned at the very beginning about your expectations are going to be.
Can you talk about that from your experience?
I bought long-term care insurance when I was 50 years old. I'm going to turn 80 this year. And I thought, oh, I'm going to be really protected. Well, between cutting back because their costs went up and the way it is administered, they have no value for supportive care. None. It's only medical. So when I tried to get the services, I had to jump through hoops, and I still haven't qualified. My husband still hasn't qualified, even though he's bedbound 24/7. And so my expectation that I had protection beyond, you know, what I would need, or at least to meet some of my needs, has been totally blown away.
Yeah.
So that's something that you don't, you know, you think, oh, I'm making this choice that's going to protect me.
And paying for it.
Yeah. And the systems, they do not value caregiving. They do not value, there's no value. And I think that's one of the really important things that we have to take responsibility for, is to care for ourselves, because the systems and the society is not going to do it for us. And that's what this group provides. It provides the link where we gather and we provide for each other the kind of value and the kind of information about how to be healthy and care for yourself and survive this, you know, really challenging role that we've been given. So I really want to thank hospice.
Yeah. And, you know, you've spoken to being in an isolated area and having a role that is isolating in itself. because when you're a 24/7 caregiver, it's not like you can say, okay, I'm going to go on a 2-week vacation from this, or even just take the weekend off. You just can't do it. So, you know, Kim, what Sue was talking about with long-term care insurance and having that only kick in when somebody is bedbound 24/7, is that a unique experience, or is that something that a lot of people face? There aren't any resources.
Well, yeah, what Sue Ray is saying is absolutely true. And furthermore, I mean, what you have to do is to demonstrate need, you have to pay out of pocket for a period of time, 3 to 6 months, depending on the policy. And that's a lot of money. You know, if you need 24/7 caregiving in your home, that's about $25,000 a month or so. And, you know, so it's just like, that's a lot of money. And that's what that long-term care insurance was supposed to address, the ability to keep your loved one at home. And receive some support. But like Sue Ray says, things have changed and they don't honor that kind of caregiving. And they wait until somebody has to be completely incapacitated before it'll kick in. So, that's very much what I find. If people have that sort of benefit, they can't use it in the way they thought they were going to.
Yeah. What was your experience? How long have you been caregiving your husband, Sue?
It's been about 8 years now, and he's, you know, he was way better off at the beginning, but he's gotten much weaker and less able to do more, but he's still able to care for himself pretty well. And when I hear the stories of people dealing with dementia, mm-hmm. I'm really grateful that he doesn't have that limitation, because the mental is so much more challenging. He's still, you know, able on a mental level to care for and make choices and, you know, be present in ways that people that have Alzheimer's and dementia just don't have access to.
Yeah.
So I've been fortunate in that. And that's the other thing about this group, really helps you to keep your situation in perspective, you know, because you might think it's pretty bad, or, you know, start getting into feeling sorry for yourself, and you're going to find the blessings, the very important and real blessings of whatever it is that is happening to you. When you see what other people are going through, and we learn to help each other to recognize the good that we're learning, and the, you know, the deepening of our own well-being and our own understanding of life's challenges and being able to meet them.
Yeah.
So we really help with that. Yeah.
I hear that support is so valued by you. I'm Chris Kington Barker with you on Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener supported radio station. Kim Chartrand, RN care manager for Hospice Slo County, and Sue Raycraft and Linda Holloway are our guests, my guests today. Sue and Linda are caregivers, and our topic today is the growing occurrence and impact of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, and also just caregiving from the perspective of caregivers in general and the challenges that are faced today. If you'd like to be able to ask a question of Linda or Sue or Kim, you can send it to voices@kcbx.org or call your question or comment in at 805-781-3875. And Linda, I'm going to go back to you. When you talk about, you know, what Sue also talked about disappointments, you kind of had one thing stacked on top of one another with your husband's circumstances. You started with probably what you thought was going to be a simple knee surgery and time for rehab and recovery. And it doesn't sound like that cloud ever lifted. Can you talk a little bit from your perspective of how that's been for you?
It's been a long road, as you said. Yeah, a knee operation. Bad knees tend to run in his family. So everybody in the family's had one or two knees replaced. Unfortunately, my side of the family doesn't seem to have that issue. But yeah, so it's just like, okay, go in and have the knee operation, a little bit of therapy. He'll be back up and to work and, you know, but it didn't go that way. One thing or another, therapy didn't go as well. And a lot of that is a personality thing because he's always been a jock type person and I don't need to work out to do what I want to do. But then the lab reports kept saying the kidneys weren't working. So you think, okay, simple fix. We'll do vitamins, this, that, and the other, and we'll be all better. Well, that wasn't the fix. More tests, and we have multiple myeloma. So, you know, you sort of buck up and you say, okay, we can handle this. You know, this is a somewhat minor. They caught it very, very early. He was himself going through all the cancer treatments. The day he came out with the clean bill of health, he wore a Darth Vader hat out of Stanford Hospital. You know, this was scary. You know, I'm sitting in the background mortified, but hey, this is his journey. Let him do what he wants to do. And, you know, in the meantime, about that time, I retired from 40 years of working, thinking, okay, now we get to start doing what I wanted to do for all these years that I put on hold. And then the shuffling started. One vehicle gets totaled. Typical, he says he wasn't at fault. I've come across the police records that sort of said he was at fault. This is where then the dementia gets, you know, kicked in. And, you know, for a long time, he was sort of himself. But with time, we've had more and more things come up. So it's a long walk. I think the hardest part with dementia is there is no manual. There is no what comes next. It's sort of long-term waiting game. And then you go, aha, that's a new change. It's happened for a week and a half now. But again, you don't know what the next phase is going to be.
You talked to when you spoke about the doctor's helpful intervention by making the diagnosis, you were able to take Gary's keys away and
correct,
not have him drive. Has it been helpful for you to have those kind of interventions? And are there times that professionals have failed you in this, or the system, the healthcare system, has failed you?
It was a blessing because I saw more and more, and it then put the weight on the medical people that this was their diagnosis, not a spouse saying you're not able to do this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. Particularly as things continued to progress in a downward spiral. The blessing is I've been able to take over the finances, get, you know, we already had a trust and a will and all of that, but this enabled me to take care of the financials, take care of everything, put it where it was manageable for me.
So you could step in.
I was able to step in. I knew at that point things were going to get worse. So it was a blessing. I mean, people say, well, that's terrible to say, but sort of when you get the heads up from the medical, this is what it is. And you do a little research and go, it's not going to get, you just sort of jump in and say, okay, it's time. And as I said, when the first bill didn't get paid, then it's like, okay, I'll just take over doing it. I'm retired now. I can do it. And he wasn't fighting me. And so you think that's a little bit, his brain's going, well, okay, I can't quite manage this and be on top of it anymore. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't going to fight me on it. I have two boys and they've been totally above board as far as understanding what's going on and supportive of me. So I'm not fighting family on this. And I think that's, they don't live close, so they're not here to help me physically, but mentally. It's some of the people in the care group, they haven't had that. They've had the denial of the family members, the people that won't show up and help and even sit for 2 hours with their loved one so that the caregiver can get out and go do something. I don't have my boys showing up, but I do have the phone calls on a regular basis to know that I'm doing the best I can, and they're supportive of that.
I'm glad to hear that. And we're going to take a break and be back in just a minute.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, next time on Latino USA. My conversation with journalist Nicole Hannah Jones, author of The 1619 Project. and a visit to her 1619 Freedom School in Waterloo, Iowa.
We know how to educate our kids. We just refuse to do it.
That's next time on Latino USA.
On the next Fresh Air, investigative journalist and author of Fast Food Nation, Eric Schlosser, joins us to talk about his latest look into our nation's food systems and how mergers and acquisitions have created food oligopolies that are inefficient, barely regulated, and in some instances, dangerous. Join us.
Some experts worry that investments in AI will lead to something like the dot-com bubble. But the growth of the two technologies does have some key differences.
You know, if you think about how much infrastructure will be necessary for AI, it will probably be even more than what the internet was.
I'm Kristen Schwab. The potential boom and bust of AI, next time on Marketplace.
Military justice is undergoing its biggest overhaul in a generation as the services grapple with sexual assault. Victims say there's a lot of work to be done.
That trust was grossly abused and then destroyed because of the lack of accountability year after year after year.
I'm Ari Shapiro. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's a look ahead today on our Thursday here on KCBX. We've got Latino USA coming up at 2 o'clock, followed by Fresh Air at 3, Marketplace at 4, and then All Things Considered from 4:30 to 6:30. Right now, let's return to Chris Kington Barker and her guests on Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Chris.
Thank you, Brad. And if you just recently joined us for today's show, you are listening to Kim Chartrand, RN, care manager for Hospice San Luis Obispo County, Sue Raycraft, and Linda Holloway, who are caregivers. And we have been talking about caregiving and the challenges that are faced in trying to navigate through healthcare systems in this country, finding resources, and just trying to find resources within ourselves when we're caregiving to try and make it through every day, sometimes every minute. And how do we maintain our own selves, our own lives, and cope with all of the demands that are on us as caregivers? And I'm going to go back to you, Kim, because Linda had mentioned about how she had to take over so many tasks, and I'm sure Sue has too, for her husband with dementia, for Linda, like the finances. Do you find that when you're doing care management, sometimes people don't have a plan in place, or they don't have a trust or a will, or they don't really understand, as Linda did, when is a time to step in and how to even do that?
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's the thing that makes it the hardest, I think, because there's a sense that we think that we want life to look a certain way. We want our life to be okay, and we want to be okay in it. Mm-hmm. So we don't want to look at some of these things. And I think there's a general resistance to doing advanced health planning, because it's sort of like, it's almost like if you think if you talk about it, that it's going to happen or it's going to make it happen. But instead, it's like the most basic thing. And in fact, just a couple days ago, April 14th was National Health Decision Day. And that's a time when people are encouraged to look at the kind of answering the question, who will speak for you when you can't speak for yourself? And so you want to be able to have somebody who wants what you want, not what they want, but what you want to have done, and how you want to be treated at towards the end of your life. Or if you can't speak, it doesn't even need to be at end of life, because sometimes we have catastrophic automobile accidents, a person's in a coma, they can't speak. Who's going to be your ambassador with the healthcare team that is, you know, you're going to be getting the treatment that you needed or that you want, or not getting treatment that you don't want? So that's the thing to really pay attention to, that planning. And it's a lot of things that get thrown at people at the last minute. You don't expect these things. I kind of like Linda mentioned, you know, oh, at last, okay, we're going to be doing the things I've been waiting. I've had my life on hold, kind of waiting to do these things. Now we can do it. And then just having that kind of that rug pulled out from under you. I mean, she was fortunate in that she had plans in place. So that made it a little easier. But there are a lot of people who don't, and they don't realize that if you don't have plans in place, things like accessing your spouse's account when you need to, if you don't have power of attorney or a trust in place, you know, sometimes you can't. And then you've got to go down the route of conservatorship, which is horrible and expensive. And I don't think anyone wants to do that. So it just really helps to make a plan.
Well, and there are people expect that they'll be able to just go in and say, my husband or my wife, my significant other is no longer in capacity to be able to do this. I need to pay our bills and be able to access finances. You cannot. If right. your name isn't on the account, you can't get the money. So it doesn't matter. And it's timely to get a physician to sign something that then becomes a legal document that you can then take to the bank, or they'll tell you you need to present a death certificate. So if the person isn't deceased, that's not possible. So, and I agree, people don't realize this. They just think that if you're legally married or there's some legal document, it will roll to you, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I encountered this a couple years ago when my husband actually started our T-Mobile bills or something like that. And so his name was on the account. And when I tried to access the account to pay the bill, they're like, we can't talk to you. And I'm like, excuse me, I'm trying to pay you money, you know? So it happens, and we just have to be sure and just be realistic about it. Then you mentioned, you know, the physician note, but sometimes what's even more important from like accessing bank accounts is having that financial power of attorney too. That's something that, you know, when somebody becomes incapacitated, making sure that you have that to present to banks and financial institutions is really important. And as well as the letter from the doctor saying this person doesn't have capacity at this point to make financial decisions.
Yeah, they need both. Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially financial institutions. Yeah, I tried to, after my mother was deceased, I tried to take her cable equipment back.
Uh-huh.
They wanted a death certificate in order to do that. And I would have never thought that that would be necessary. But again, I couldn't talk to them because I wasn't on the bill.
Yeah. Oh, it's nuts.
You probably see with technology too, if people are not technologically savvy and one member has been doing banking online, and another person is the surviving person and doesn't know how to do that, that can get to be a conundrum too.
Oh, absolutely, because you know, you get notifications via email, and if you don't have access to that person's email about bills due or those notifications set up, absolutely. One thing we really advocate for at hospice is something we call a survivor's notebook, and it means that you're setting, it's things to set up to help the surviving people in the event of your death, you know, understand how are you accessing these things? What are your passwords? What do people need to pay attention to? And so there are several steps you can take to kind of put together this notebook, along with instructions of what to do after my death, because there's some amazing, you know, things that get forgotten, you know, of like the steps to take and people don't know. And, you know, you're busy grieving, honestly. And so, you know, you want to, you know, be able to be free to do that and not have to pay attention to so much of fact finding. One of the things that my husband and I found when his stepfather died was we didn't know that he had had any burial plans. He hadn't talked to us. He wouldn't talk to us about it. So we were in the process of making those. And then we happened to be going through his stuff. And we found that he had a policy, or he had some plans to the Veterans Administration and had a specific burial plot that he'd paid for. And all of a sudden, and it's like, well, that would have been helpful to know before we were down. Anyway, so having these conversations are really, really, really important. And you're doing your family a big gift to do that. So
what are some, Kim, when we talk about the cost of things, what are or are there some resources for low cost respite and help for caregivers? Is there access for some of this?
Yes, there is access for some. I think some people feel like they're sort of owed caregiving and respite, or that insurance is going to pay for it, or Medicare is going to pay for it. And of course, that's not true. But there are a lot of agencies. We're really lucky since resources vary from county to county within the state. It's not like it's exactly portable. So what services you get in one county, you might not get in another. But with Hospice Slo County, we have a couple of organizations. Of course, Hospice Slo, as we've mentioned, we provide volunteer respite. So it helps the caregiver be able to get out, and it allows the person that they're caring for to have some contact with another individual. We kind of call it psychosocial emotional care. Then there's another group run through Cottage Hospital of Santa Barbara, which is called Coast Caregiver Resource Center. The Caregiver Resource Centers is a national program, and California has several of them. And so they tend to be regional. So our regional one is called Coast Caregiver Resource Center. And there's support for the caregiver. They have a respite grant that they provide for people. They hire from local caregiving agencies that provide, non-licensed caregiving in the home, so they can do bathing and personal care and things like that. But it most importantly gives the caregiver a break, and it is free of charge. Wilshire Community Services, another really fabulous organization, they don't necessarily provide respite, but they have actually in-home peer-to-peer counseling. They have volunteers that'll do errands. They have volunteer transportation. And there's lots of different transportation options out there if people need it. We do have a very active adult day health center up in Paso Robles that is where people can take their person and get some respite. There's also an adult day health center in Santa Maria, the Wisdom Center. So it's just those are valuable assets for people to be able to get some support.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you find, Kim, are some of the learnings that are maybe not happy learnings about assumptions people make for what Medicare and insurances are covering and what they're not?
Right. There's an assumption that people, facility level care for the long term will be paid for. Like I've talked to people before, they'll say, oh yeah, my wife has dementia, but I'm just going to put her in Sydney Creek. And I'm like, oh, okay, great. You have the resources to pay for that. Oh no, but Medicare is going to pay for it. It's kind of like, okay. So then it's kind of like an undoing of assumptions there. It's like, no, that's actually cash pay, fee for service. That's not what Medicare pays. Medicare doesn't pay for any long-term care. They will pay for short stints of rehab after you've had 3 days of hospitalization, but that only lasts for maybe 2-3 weeks at the very most. And then a person's going to need to get transferred to a different level of care, either home. There are residential care facilities that people can access, or of course assisted living, memory care, but that's all again fee for service.
There is an assumption sometimes that because people have someone at home, they can be discharged home from the hospital. And what if a caregiver isn't capable of taking care of that person? Do they have to accept them back home?
No, actually. So there's a state law, and it's actually, relatively recent in the last few years. And that was because people were getting discharged to unsafe situations. So if a caregiver says this person has gone beyond my capacity to care, then what happens is the hospital is required to find other alternatives. Now, hospitals may resort to ways of kind of threatening the caregiver, saying, well, you're going to have to pay cash for this, or you have to do this, but that's not true. So it's important for the caregiver to stay strong and just say, this situation is not safe for my loved one. It's not safe for me. And I can't accept the patient. So for my loved one at home. So you have to just be strong.
That's really important for people it here because I recently had someone tell me that they were incapable of taking care of the loved one because the person was just so advanced and unable to care for them, unable to pick them up, unable to, the person was no longer able to get out of bed. And the wife was told, if we have to hospitalize him somewhere, we're going to send him down to LA.
Right.
With the threat that you'll probably never see him again before he dies.
Yeah. And the sad truth about, unfortunately, there aren't a lot of what's considered a custodial bed. So a person that needs long-term care at the skilled nursing facilities. So what we commonly refer to as nursing homes. But very, very often, and especially if they need an extra skilled level of care, which is like a feeding tube or any other kinds of things like that, then the person does actually, they are discharging out of the county oftentimes. Mm-hmm. It's been as far south as San Diego for some families. And it's just terrible. It's just like, it's just an awful thing, but we're not the only county going through that, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And it's really a bad situation. There tends to be other, people are forced into other options, which is more the cash paying residential care facilities or other options, or cash paying for a skilled nursing facility. Somehow the beds show up if you've got the money. So
isn't that interesting? Yeah. I'm Chris Kington Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX. If you recently joined us today and you want to enjoy the entire broadcast, it'll be available on our website at kcbx.org under the On Demand tab. Click on Central Coast Voices and you'll find this show along with many other of our past shows to choose from. Kim Chartrand, RN Care Manager for Hospice San Luis Obispo County, Sue Raycraft and Linda Holloway, caregivers here in San Luis Obispo County, have joined me today for today's show. And we have about 15 minutes left in today's show and still time if you want to call in any questions to ask of our guests. And you can do that by calling 805-781-3875. Linda, Sue, I wanted to ask you, when you're in the caregiver support group, did you find from being in that group that you were able to say things to that group that you didn't feel comfortable saying to other people and that needed to be said out loud?
Yeah, that is a very common experience. We're always commenting on that other people just do not have a clue, basically. Caring is not being able to share really necessarily. And so, yeah, just saying what's coming up for you and just not worrying about, well, are they going to understand? Are they going to judge? Is this inappropriate? Will it make them uncomfortable? All those things. I mean, you're in this group and you know that this experience that you're sharing is valuable, valued, understood, appreciated, and you can just say whatever. And it is really liberating. It's so different because it's not easy for people to deal. People in this culture, they don't want to talk about death. They don't want to talk about, and like the discussion we just had about the lack of resources. I mean, recently it's been brought up in the political sphere that there's unpaid care being given that needs to be brought into being covered and finding a way for the general good, that's administered by government and by resources to be covered. And man, how long did that discussion last? Like 3 seconds? I haven't even heard it brought up again. It's like, we don't want to talk about it because it's too hard.
Yeah.
And, so as in this group and in this process, nothing is too hard. It's all what we're experiencing. It's real. It's authentic. And being willing and able to be honest is such a gift of the process. So, yeah, thanks for asking that question because it's really important.
You know, the thing that is happening now is that all ages are coming into being caregivers. Mm-hmm. We're finding that Gen Z, millennials are coming into being caregivers at the same time that they're having their own children. They're faced with caregiving, perhaps parents or grandparents or sometimes both. And something that is not uncommon is that there are folks who are caregivers, but they're caregivers of more than one person. It's not limited to one person. So they may be caregiving for both parents or both parents and grandparents. And it is because there is no place, and it's not, it's our families are no longer multi-generational families living together the way we used to in earlier centuries, where we had multiple people that were resources for taking shifts, for taking turns and caring for elders or caring for sick children. It often is left to one person. And here's the rub. That person often is the woman.
Of course.
And there are a lot of men that do beautiful caregiving and come and support their person as well as women do. But more times than not, statistically, it is still women who end up with the boatload of caregiving.
It's true.
You want to say anything about that, Kim? You kind of...
Oh gosh, yeah. I've been nodding emphatically. I'll get the calls from the daughters-in-law and the daughters, and that, you know, it is very much that, you know, or the wife, you know, the spouse, the female spouse. It's very very common, and I think, you know, we're used to doing caregiving. We care, you know, women caregive. You know, generally speaking, they're also the responsible ones for their children. You know, typically, I think, you know, hopefully we're moving away, so it's just more all access for care. But that tends to be what we see. So,
yeah, Linda, I was asking Sue about what she finds is really supportive with the support group and what she's able to express in the support group and that she couldn't before. How have you found the support group helpful for you?
Well, I think from my point of view, it's a safe environment that we do, you know, it's not an advice column, but we are there to support each other. And sometimes you've tried something with your person and it's worked and you can share with somebody else. How about trying this? Like, the distraction with dementia, sort of, you know, you have different scenarios, but you can share that. But I think the other part, sometimes you see the grief that people are going through, that's supportive because we're all going through that to a certain extent. It's called anticipatory grief. And what is it going to be like in the future? Those are things you can talk to people about. You can't always talk to them with your children or anybody else because they don't understand. They're saying, you know, they say, well, that's pretty morbid. You're already thinking about when he's died. Well,
yeah.
It's the truth. We do.
So. Are there days that you have where you think, I just wish this was over?
I think we all do at some point.
How can you not?
You know, when you have dementia, you know, it's, quote, a death sentence. It may take 2 years. It may take 10 years. But you know that it's not a regular old age that I'm going to experience with my husband.
And it's also out of love.
Right.
You know, because you care for the person, you don't like to see. I mean, it's
hard to see them walk down the walk. Yeah,
suffer. You were mentioning before we came on the show, Linda, as a caregiver, it is sometimes difficult to be the person that, when dealing with someone, and this is not unique to only to dementia, because I've heard this from other folks too, when you're caregiving for someone alone, it is sometimes hard to be the person that is setting limits, that is giving direction about what they need to be eating or changing or doing, that it makes it helpful to have someone else take over for that from time to time.
Right. Yeah, it is. You go from being a spouse to, in my case, there's times I'm talking to a 4 or 5 year old. It makes it difficult. And there's times you do need to have somebody else step in and that understands, you know, the caregiver we have coming in, he totally understands what I'm talking about. Not judgmental. It's just, how do we change the care for the 2 hours that he's here, that he can do things that I don't have to deal with. So yes, it is a blessing.
And I love that the group, that first that Kim is there as a care manager to give you resources and also advice and give tips, and that you are able to do that with each other and share information that worked about, you know, have you tried this? Have you tried that? That is so important. And I'm hoping that you do the same thing about taking care of yourselves.
We try. I know a number of people get together and do different things. So, yeah, I mean, we've gone to Madonna Inn for dancing. We try to get together at different points, but if nothing else, it's the Friday afternoon that we all look forward to.
And we're just about out of time, but I also want to share, you know, one of the statistics that I shared before coming on this show from the 2024 California Alzheimer's statistics is that caregivers are estimated 61% of them have some kind of a chronic disease. And doing their caregiving is a big part of that. So take care of yourselves. And thank you all for being on this show today. I really, really appreciate you being here.
Thank you for hosting it, Chris.
I want to thank my guests today. Kim Chartrand, RN, Care Manager for Hospice of San Luis Obispo County. Sue Ray Kraft and Linda Holloway, caregivers, and so appreciated that you were being here. Next week, please join Lada Morty and her guests, Race Matters Slow, and they're going to be talking about films from Black filmmakers for the Slow Film Festival. Center Coast Voices has been sponsored by the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX. I'm Chris Kington-Barker. Thank you for joining us today.